The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
The main character of Plug is dirty and disgusting, and there's a scene in this film and you see he's got his big mutton chops, he's wearing a hat, he's making these grunting sounds.
The terrible Australian B. Jemine.
Marcy, there's a scene for poor Barry McKenzie where French police shoot up an entire box of Foster's beer with machine guns.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
No, absolutely nothing. There's nothing there. This is shit. This is a shithole of a movie.
Mature themes.
I knew it was going to be a documentary about sex, but I thought it would be more about love and relationships and stuff like that. I didn't realise it was going to be about venereal diseases.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to the long-awaited new episode of the Ozploycast, the podcast where my co-host Super Marcy and I take a deep dive into Australia's Ozploitation movement from the very beginning right up until today. And with me, as always, is my very Aussie co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
G'day, Bede. I'm feeling extra Aussie today for some reason. I seem to when we record the Ozploit cast, because every episode we do watch 5 Ozploitation movies. So it's hard not to feel a bit Aussie or extra Aussie when you're watching quite a number of Australian wacky films.
Oh, yeah, that's right, mate. I feel even more Australian than usual. I got me billabong hat on. I also have my VB and also got my singlet. And also, I'm going to go fight a kangaroo after this podcast.
And I'm going to go down to the Bottle-O and buy a slab.
Yes. I may be doing the Australian burger, because to be on a slight tangent, Marcy, I was at the movies the other day.
Yes.
And the trailer that showed beforehand was Spit, the sequel to Getting Square, where David Wenham reprises his role.
Yes, I've been waiting 20-something years for this.
And it's the of course, like, he plays a character who's the most bogan character in the history of Australian cinema. So,
if Getting Square is not an easy film to find, but I highly recommend people try find it, because it is a fantastic Australian, like, prime comedy. And it was before, I guess, everyone turned on Sam Worthington, right?
Yes. And also, just as David Wenham was about to blow up as well.
Yeah, he's got, like, the best hair.
Yes.
If you want to know exactly what a bogan is, you just have to look at his character in that film.
Exactly. But unfortunately, there are no bogans besides us on this show, Marcy, because on the episode today, we are joined by a very special guest who has been a regular guest on our other shows on the Super Network, but he is making his first ever appearance on this one. And he's also our second American to be on this show. And that, of course, is the killer horror critic himself, Matt Konopka. Hello, Matt, and welcome to the show.
Hello, thanks for having me. So does this mean I get to be like an honorary Aussie for like the next hour, since I also watched 5 movies in the last 2 days?
Yes.
Although, given the 5 movies we're discussing, I don't know what you're quite to think of Australia.
It's okay. I mean, I've seen a lot of really great Australian films as well, so they will not alter my view in any way.
Well, that's the thing, though. When people come on the show, like, they go through our list of episodes and they say, oh yeah, I want to come on and talk about that movie in particular, but then they realize, oh, I gotta watch these 5 other movies I've never even heard of, and they sit there and watch them and be like, what the hell am I watching?
Yeah, you definitely got me with one particular one we're talking about today, and the others were mostly new to me, where I was just kind of like, huh, all right, that's an interesting one.
And also, I got to say, before I reveal what the films we're going to be tackling for this episode are, I sort of realized, looking in the order which we will discuss them, they kind of go from least craziest to absolute craziest.
Yes.
Awesome.
But before we reveal what those films are, Matt, I have a very important question I need to ask you. Since this is a podcast that explores Ozploitation, do you remember the very first Australian Ozploitation film that you saw, or at least in terms of Australian genre films that you could think of?
Oh, man.
And did you possibly learn about Ozploitation from the documentary Not Quite Hollywood?
No, to the latter.
Amazing.
I'm trying to remember, what was the first Ozploitation film I saw?
I mean, a lot of people we've had saw the documentary, but also things like Mad Max or The Road Warrior, because they were, at least The Road Warrior was big internationally.
Yeah, I guess if we're including that, then that would probably be the first one. And then the first that I would consider horror, I believe, is Wolf Creek was maybe the first I saw.
And we do consider that Ozploitation.
For sure. You know.
But yeah, that's a good point.
I believe Wolf Creek was my first horror film, and then Mad Max definitely the first Australian film I saw.
Nice.
I think you might be the first guest that didn't discover everything from Not Quite Hollywood, or at least realize.
Yeah. I don't know. I might have to watch it again and refresh myself.
But Mad Max or Mad Max 2 is usually the big one because they were so known everywhere. And if you're talking about non-Ozploitation, it's usually something like Crocodile Dundee.
It's either that.
It was early in my life.
Or Yahoo Serious.
Yes. Exactly. But for this episode of the show, and I realize, Marcin, you brought this up just before we started recording, is now with this episode, we are now up to 100 movies that we have covered for this show, and we still have a ton more to dive into in future installments.
Officially, with what we've watched on this episode, it's 102 Ozploitation films we have watched and discussed on this podcast.
Indeed. And I'm very much looking forward to discussing all five of these films for this episode. And since Matt is a film critic who specializes in talking about horror, we've made this an all-horror episode of the show. And for this episode, we're going to be looking at the films Dangerous Game, Contagion, Coda, Outback Vampires, and Howling Free, The Marsupials. So we might as well get straight to it and discuss our very first film, which is the 1987 horror film Dangerous Game.
He was a cop on the edge of sanity.
I'm suspending you pending further psychiatric tests.
They were just some kids out for a good time.
No, the bet was that you could break into any computer system in the world.
How about Mark Wells' department store?
It was only a simple game.
Just relax, there's nobody here.
Until he changed the rules.
Breaking an entrance.
Now, there can only be one winner. Some games are fun. Some games are risky. And some games are just dangerous. Dangerous Game.
Police.
Man, hide from me! Avoid you! Come on! I'll kill you!
I've got something special for you.
Which was directed by Stephen Hopkins. Yes, the same director behind A Nightmare on Elm Street 5, Predator 2, Lost in Space, and many others. And this was actually his directorial debut as well. It was written by Peter West. The film stars Miles Buchanan, Marcus Graham, Stephen Grise, Catherine Walker, Sadie Lillingston, and John Paulson. And the plot summary, which I'm reading off IMDb, is a computer expert and his friends manage to disable a department store security system so they can rob it. But once inside, they find themselves stalked by a killer. Now, as I sort of stated before, this was the directorial debut of Stephen Hopkins, who would go on to be a big name in both film and television and is still very much working today and even has won a few Emmys for his work in the process. So I was very curious to sit down and watch Dangerous Game, knowing that this was his directorial debut. But the question is, though, what did we think of the film overall? So, Marcy, tell us your thoughts on Dangerous Game.
Yeah, so unhinged cop traps teens in a department store to be unhinged to them.
This sounds like a news report I just read yesterday.
I mean, literally. And then you think, well, how did this unhinged cop get hired in the first place? But then you're like,
answer your own question.
As Bede mentioned, this was Stephen Hopkins' directorial debut. And many, many years ago, I can't even remember, it would have been well over 10 years ago, when I did a dissecting the director back on Arrow in the Head, and I did Stephen Hopkins, this was something I just could not find back then. So I'm glad we can actually see it now, but I guess it was almost like almost considered A Nightmare on Elm Street 5 to be like his debut. And while I think it's not the best Elm Street movie, what's captivating about it is how it looks visually and the style that's put into the film and giving us something quite different. And I find that with quite a number of Stephen Hopkins films, even if it's something that's really not great, like Lost in Space, it's own unique vision. So getting back to this film, being able to actually find it and be able to watch it after knowing that it exists and like, okay, this mysterious movie of Stephen Hopkins, finally. For me, this was a very style over substance type of film. And you could see a lot of aspects of, at least on a very visual and just getting from A to B in a film, it's his style. So you can see that he was always kind of this very visual person in telling stories. And I believe someone we know made mention that the original script was quite different and that Hopkins put in a lot of his own ideas and stuff to it. And I think you can see that because it does feel like it's kind of film. That said, it is still a very weird plot with this weird unhinged cop going after like 18, 19-year-olds. Mostly it's the main character who he has a vendetta against the guy's father who is passed away. Like, that's it. He somehow gets them trapped in a department store. And at first it's like, okay, it's going to be fun. But then it's like, oh no, he just like literally killed someone. And that almost like it sets off. And what I do like is that it is a very unhinged movie in that way, but it does have a good amount of suspense. And you definitely get to know sort of the teen university student kids. They're not completely likable, but really you feel for them having this guy coming after them in the way that he does. So I think it's a really interesting film, but I think it's something that definitely relies more on how it looks than the story it's telling.
And Matt, your thoughts on Dangerous Game?
Yeah, so this was a first for me, and I'm really glad that I finally got to watch it because I ended up really liking this one, which should be no surprise because I'm a big fan of Stephen Hopkins' work. I wouldn't call Nightmare 5 the best Nightmare film, not even in the top half, but I do think that it's one of the more visually interesting Nightmare films. It has this really great kind of gritty fantasy aspect to it that I think really stands out in comparison to the others. And Predator 2 is a film that I will fight tooth and nail to the death for.
Yeah.
I also think The Ghost in the Darkness that he directed is a highly underrated movie.
Fantastic.
Kind of survival horror-ish film. I'm a fan of his work, and I had never seen this before. And yeah, I ended up really liking it because even though it has some of the rough patches that you sort of expect with a debut, I do think that there is substance to the film, but I also think that it's very kind of erratic. It's a bit messy in a way, especially throughout the first act. I feel like it kind of takes a moment to really get a grip on what is going on. But why I say it has substance is that I really resonated with the kind of themes that are at the heart of this movie and the sort of rebellion of it, because the 80s were a time where, like, horror, I feel like you really started to see a lot of rebellion amongst the youth, kind of showing up in these films. Like Return of the Living Dead is a great example. Maniac Cop is one that actually came out in the same year, I believe, 1988. That's another one that kind of turns the institution in on itself and looks at cops less as the heroes and the good guys that they've been portrayed as throughout most of film history, and kind of looks at them like, no, there are unhinged people within this.
I mean, we see that we definitely understand that in the year 2025.
Yes, and so a lot of these movies were kind of like precursors to the public sort of getting to that point, right? Which often happens to be the case with films, as filmmakers are always, it feels like, predicting these things years in advance.
Literally, we would see that because it was the Rodney King incident.
Yeah, the Rodney King incident came just a few years after these. And so that rebellion had kind of started to bubble up with the Reagan years and the way that, at least in America, with the Reagan years and the way the government was kind of betraying us in a lot of ways. So I'm not, my history with Australia, I'm not as familiar with. So I don't know if there was anything in particular going on there during that time. But anyway, I'm rambling. It just, I like the movie because it kind of speaks to that frustration and sort of predicts kind of where we would end up just a few short years after, sort of beginning to look at police as an institution that you cannot always just blindly trust, right? And so I like that. I also just love that there's a hacker scene, because you can't have a late 80s or early 90s film with teenagers and not have a hacker be one of them. It's like, if you only watched movies from that period, you would think every friend group had a hacker amongst them. But yeah, no, ultimately, I think it's a solid, kind of gritty piece that really expresses just a lot of angst amongst the youth and kind of where things were going at the time. So I like it. It's a very good debut, I think.
Yeah, I have to agree as well. I thought this was a really solid debut for Stephen Hopkins. Sitting here watching it, I was just very struck on how very stylized it was. And usually, with a lot of filmmakers, especially when it comes to their debut, most of the time they'll take a pretty straightforward approach. And then over time, they'll start developing their style and the sort of the trademarks that they're best known for. But you kind of see that right out the gate with this film, because even though this film is set mostly in one location, which is this department store, Stephen Hopkins finds really interesting ways on how to shoot in these scenes. And it's just a beautiful looking film, because the film was shot by Peter Levy, and he would actually collaborate with Stephen Hopkins on more films after this, because he would also do Nightmare 5, Predator 2, Lost in Space, and a few others. And outside of their collaborations, he would also shoot other films like Broken Arrow, which is, I find, really awesome. So, oh, and Cutthroat Island. So I find that really interesting too. Their sort of collaborative nature when it came to the filmmaking aspects of this film, I think, really made it a very stylish film. There's some pretty intense sequences as well. I think the cast all give really solid performances as well. But at the end of the day, it really is Stephen Grimes who plays the villain Murphy, who kind of steals the whole movie,
I
because
mean, how does he not when he's just playing like, I don't know if I'd say it's over the top, but it's over the top, fully unhinged.
it's like over the top, but in a way that is believable, if that makes sense.
Mm.
Like,
Exactly,
it's
exactly.
so extreme and psychotic, but I never doubted him as being that. You know what I
And also, you know me, Marcy, I get hooked on specific things. I was very obsessed with the fashion in this film, particularly Miles Buchanan's character of David, who's the hacker of the bunch. Like, his outfit and hair was amazing in this film.
We got to go back to the 80s.
Exactly. And also, I was kind of, when I sat down to watch it too, is there are a couple other familiar faces in the cast who have, and this was like some of their earliest work as well, because Marcus Graham, who I know you love, Marcy, this was his acting debut in this film. And also John Paulson, who would go on to be a director in his own right, also has a role on this one as well.
And let us not forget, John Paulson is the director of The Fantastic Swim Fan.
Yes.
A classic.
A classic of classics. And also what I find interesting is apparently the department store that they used for the film was actually a set that was built. And at the time, it was the largest set ever built for an Australian film.
Honestly, I thought it was a department store because it looked like a real department store.
Wait, I want to clarify. So everything we see in this film, as far as the mall goes, was a set?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that is an extensive build.
That's insane, because I literally thought that they filmed that in a department store.
Yeah, no, the production design is fantastic. They did a great job.
Give it even more props for that, dude.
And also, it did get an actor nomination for Best Production Design. It didn't win, unfortunately, but yeah, I think it's pretty well deserved. It's when you sit there and watch the film, you wouldn't automatically think this was a set. You would think, oh, this is an actual mall or department store that they used to shoot the film.
Especially the early scenes, they're shot outside. Maybe it was a university or something similar, but they're actually like locations. Like, you would think that they're just filming at the department store.
I think that's just another credit for Hopkins. They did the coverage to really give this mall a certain character that makes you believe it exists. It feels really well shot and covered, so it feels legit.
One of my favorite aspects of doing this podcast and watching the films is finding out some really interesting things like this one. I'm just like blown away.
Yeah, and also too, when you kind of think about it, it makes sense for them to make a set, because as the film progresses, they use motorbices to go driving around the mall and destroy stuff. So I can imagine they probably wanted to use an actual mall, but I could imagine a lot of these places were, if I had to guess, probably heard what they wanted to do. We're like, yeah, no, we don't want you wrecking anything in our stores.
Yeah, it makes me even more surprised, like thinking about something like Romero's Dawn of the Dead, where they did shoot in the mall. And
yeah.
Now that I think about it, I'm like, huh, I am kind of surprised they gave them permission to do that. Definitely a reason why this one was built, because they destroy quite a bit of it.
Exactly. And I think it's just a pretty solid little horror thriller. Hopefully one day it will be rediscovered, especially since, as we all know, Stephen Hopkins would go on to be a big name director in his own right. But I could definitely see like why the makers behind A Nightmare on Elm Street saw this film. It's like, oh, we should get this guy to direct part 5, because pretty much all that directorial style that he was known for was very prevalent in this film. And he also knows how to make a pretty compelling villain as well.
Yeah. And it's interesting, like, because we have seen some debut films from well-known directors, and someone else who's absolute, just everything you would know them for, who it's very clear in their film, would be Alex Proyas with that long title that I always forget the name of.
Spirits in the Air, Gremlins in the Clouds.
Yeah, that one. And another, like, just, oh, wow, kind of debut. I mean, I do think that is a better film. But for me, that film had the style and a lot of substance. But I do find it interesting, like, that we do get to see these debut films. And at least with those two, like, what people would know them for with their films is very much there in that first one.
Right.
Definitely.
Speaking of Price's Dark City, I think, has just landed on Prime. So for anyone who's never seen it, it's amazing.
As they should. But I guess that could be a wrap on our discussion of Dangerous Game. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating out of 5 overall for the film?
Yeah, look, I think it is quite an enjoyable but intense and at times unhinged, like horror thriller. And yeah, I give it 3.5. That cop can go get fucked out of 5. You're not following me to no department store or trapping me in one. I'll break you, man. Unless he wants to be my sugar daddy, then no. But yeah, 3.5 out of 5.
And Matt, your final thoughts and rating for the film?
Let me ask you two a quick question. Just because I'm a nerd for this stuff and I love kind of getting a feel for some of these films. Do you know if there was like any sort of gun issue or anything like that in Australia in 1988? Because I believe you all banned guns or something to that extent in the 90s.
It was in the 90s, but back in the 80s, I was very little. So on memory, I don't really know. The only memories I have of guns, because I never really saw guns, it would be a really locked up guns and ammo store, and you wouldn't see very many of them.
Right.
And they'd be all caged up.
Well, so I only ask because there are sort of these sequences in the film where the characters are just so easily kind of... I always just find it fascinating when a film touches on this with something like a mall, where it's like they can go shopping in a luxury clothing store, and then right next to it is a gun store that they can just break into and easily arm themselves. And I just found it really interesting how the film seemed to be talking a lot about that kind of violence and stuff. And yes, and I also want to just say, if you also are not a fan of the police, then this is a horror film for you. But I'm going to go ahead and give it a 3.5 out of 5 as well. Like I said, it's got its rocky moments, but otherwise, really stylish, thrilling, suspenseful, a really solid debut. Really enjoyed this one.
Yeah, I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5 as well. And it's kind of funny you mentioned that, Matt, is like I almost forgot that they do have guns in the movie. So when the scene where they find sort of the department store that has all the guns in, I was like slightly taken aback. And I'm thinking like, oh yeah, this was like way, way before guns were...
But I don't feel like I have memories of guns being sold in department stores. Like, the guns and ammo shops were all, like, caged up, and they'd be, like, not inside a department store. So it was a bit like, ah?
Yeah, which is fascinating to me, because here, I mean,
yeah,
there are places like, you can just walk in and buy them at a department store.
And also, thinking about it now, if they made this movie today, those characters would be fucked, because they'd be like, oh yeah, it's... No Australian department store has guns. So, right. But I think it's a pretty solid little horror thriller. Not an amazing film by any means, but it is pretty well made. It has some pretty solid performances. And it's a good little calling card for Stephen Hopkins as a filmmaker. And you can definitely see the potential he has as one. And we would see that later on down the track with his other work.
Yeah, he has a really great kind of gritty signature to him that I think he brought to the films that he did right after this, and I really appreciate that.
And actually, thinking about it now, you could do this film as a double feature with his other film that he made a few years later, Judgment Night, with Emilio Estevez. Because that film kind of has a very similar kind of vibe and tone as well, but probably even more grittier. Moving right along to our next film, which of course is another horror film that came out in 1987. Well, I should say all these films on this episode all came out in 1987. For this one, we're going to be talking about the film Contagion.
You seen this one, eh? Of course, it doesn't actually show them doing it. You know, I mean, it's not a... Well, have you got one of those?
Come back! wondered if you'd have the courage.
I hope I'm not.
Of course not. We're delighted to see you. Will you tell Rudy that Mark's here? He'll be so pleased to see you again. He pretends to be a hermit, but he really loves having visitors. I am glad to see you again, Mark. I felt a kind of empathy with you.
Which was directed by Carl Zwicky, written by Ken Mephol. This film stars John Doyle, Nicola Barrett, Ray Barrett, Naffy Gaffney, and Jacqueline Brennan. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading off IMDb once again, is a real estate agent is lured to a rundown mansion only to be trapped and tortured by ghosts. Now, this one, of course, I have heard quite a while, especially in the few years when we were developing this show, Marcy. So I was very curious to sit down and watch Contagion. I would say there's definitely a lot to talk about with this one. So Marcy, tell us your initial thoughts of Contagion.
I don't know if there's much for me to say. I feel like Contagion is somewhere between genius and nightmare.
Yeah.
But... it has some interesting ideas, but it does really nothing with them. And it just felt more odd than much of a movie. Like, I don't know if it really achieved what it wanted to or if it wanted to. This is one of the, I know for me, this is just one of those films that had some potential, but just really didn't get there. I was just very met on this film because I just was like, okay, this is happening, but huh? Okay. And I'm like, but you're not really doing anything with this. And then it was the end. So yeah, I don't know if I have a lot to say on it rather than it was just there. I don't know. I almost feel like this movie is, I don't think they were ghosts. It was all in this guy's head and it doesn't even really give you, I don't know. It doesn't know what it is, but that's what I took away from it, and I didn't really find it that interesting.
And Matt, your thoughts on Contagion?
Yeah, so I would have to agree with Marcy on this. I intentionally didn't read any of the synopses for these films that I was unfamiliar with, and that applied here as well. So I went into this blind, and to start off, I was really intrigued. I thought the film started decently strong, with our main character kind of driving through this dark part of the outback, and then he happens across this woman who's being harassed and all that horrible stuff. And I sort of took it as like, okay, he goes and he is attacked by these masked people, right? And I sort of thought that this was going to lead to a really interesting place of kind of evil, like the idea of evil as a contagion and kind of how like a violent act precursors another violent act and that kind of stuff. And that's sort of what the film felt like it wanted to be. It just all felt so disconnected.
It's like an anthology that's not an anthology, because you have this first scene where you're introduced to the main character, horrible stuff happens, and then suddenly like you're thinking, okay, kind of he'll survive or something. But then there's this mansion and you're supposed to think it's haunted, but I actually think it was in his head. And I don't think the movie quite knows what it wanted to be. And there's some part of like making money and getting rich. Yeah, what the fuck is happening?
It's like you go from this really kind of deep, dark place with these seedy characters and this awful stuff happening. And then suddenly we're in a mansion and he's having threesomes for a creepy old guy smoking a cigar who's like Mr. Burns in The Simpsons cackling as he plays the stock market. Which, by the way, I mean, the things, like, none of that works that way. I don't know. There was just so much in this where it lost me so quickly, where I was just like, wait a minute, this is not the movie you started with, and I'm not sure what you want us to think here. But like you were saying, Marcy, I just felt like it maybe had an idea of what it wanted to achieve that I think was interesting, but it didn't get there because it stuffs this so full of kind of bizarre, wacky occurrences that I just feel like by the end that sort of theme was lost.
Yeah, I think where to start with my thoughts on Contagion. I agree with you, Matt. I think when it starts off quite interesting because, again, I didn't read the plot summary for this film. I kind of just went into it blind as well. So the first 15, 20 minutes definitely had me very intrigued, although I was kind of very taken aback that John Doyle. Now, for a lot of our non-Australian listeners, you probably don't know who John Doyle is, but here in Australia, he's a well-known comedian who's one half of an Australian sporting theme comedy duo called Roy and HG. And that's like, but I think this was like very early in his career. So it was kind of just weird watching him as the lead in this film and just seeing his descent into madness. As the film kind of progresses, it starts throwing in so much elements to the story that it does become an absolute mess because like you both say, there's this whole sort of subplot where the character of Bale, played by Ray Barrett, and I'm wondering why Ray Barrett, who we've talked about a lot on this show, Marcy, was in this movie, but he kind of tells Mark about his plan on how to get rich, and he goes out and does that, and if anyone gets in Mark's way, he kills them. So, and also, like you say, Matt, he does sleep with both Bale's daughters as well, but we're not sure, again, if they're ghosts or if it's all in his head. And Mark's girlfriend, Cheryl, is very concerned about all of this. So, like, so many things are going on in this movie, but unfortunately, it doesn't really gel together. The thing is, though, and you touched on this too, Matt, is with the title of Contagion. I was very curious why the film was called Contagion. And
I still wonder why it's called Contagion.
Because essentially the film kind of says that evil is kind of like a virus and it can contaminate people and turn them into evil beings, which I guess is what the film was trying to do with Mark, who was just like this
but
normal guy.
Very lost in translation. What happens is so taken away from the beginning.
That's the thing. That was my biggest issue.
Is that what's turned him now evil? Or
It confuses it so much, right? Because
he's at a mansion having threesomes with the guy watching. Sorry, I'm cutting you off. But it just, I don't know. I feel like the movie should have been called Madness because it's one man's madness that we see through this, but it doesn't do anything. I don't know. I don't get
Well, it's why it ended up being such a disappointment for me, because I really like films that kind of explore that sort of idea of like what happens to us after experiencing this kind of violence or whatever. And that's what the film is setting up in the beginning, right? Is discussing evil as sort of a sickness and a contagion and the way that it sort of spreads. And so you feel like, okay, well, we open with him encountering this violence to sort of show and imply like how we're leading to him becoming a violent person. But then you throw in all of this like haunting crap and play in the stock market. And it's just like, what are we doing now? What are we doing?
Is it the evils of stock market? I don't fucking know.
Well, and this is part of the problem is like the film felt like it couldn't decide which theme it really wanted to play, because first you're kind of talking about this evil, and then later you have lines like, you simply can't be rich and honest, which is true. I would agree with that. Rich people are generally scum. It's not impossible for films to have multiple themes, obviously, but it's just this one didn't really feel like it hammered home. It couldn't focus on either of them.
It's a very weird film. I mean, I could see what it's going for, but I feel like it was a film that had some pretty lofty ideas, but I don't think the screenplay was able to kind of make it all work together. And because of that, I think the performances kind of suffer as well, because I can see what John Doyle is doing with his performance, but he just feels so miscast in the role. And yeah, it's just a very, very weird movie. And we've covered quite a lot of weird movies on this show, Marcy. And this one is definitely up there. But unfortunately, I don't, even though there's some interesting elements to it, but yeah, it just doesn't really work overall.
No, it doesn't. It really doesn't know what it wants to be. It could have been a nightmarish genius type of movie, but no.
Mm-hmm. Although I will say, being someone who's less familiar with Doyle, I felt less like he was miscast, and then I thought being able to look at it from perspective of someone who's less familiar with him. Granted, he also didn't have much to work with because the script is, oh, it's just, ooh, it's a mess.
Looking up Carl's Wiki's work, Marcy, he would direct other films after this one, including one which we will talk about in a future episode of this show. But he's kind of just stuck mainly to television here in Australia. And Marcy, you might be excited about this. He has directed 16 episodes of your favorite show, Neighbours.
Well, that's good. If you want my respect, you direct an episode of Neighbours.
And he also directed episodes of Heartbreak High and also Home and Away.
I wonder if those episodes were as wacky as this movie.
I hope so. I really do hope so.
Ghost threesomes and all.
Exactly, exactly. And he also directed episodes of the kids' show, High Five.
Okay, now my mind's blown.
I wonder if there were also creepy voyeuristic men in this kids' show.
I hope not. I really, really hope not. Oh, he also directed episodes of Ship the Shore. See, my mind is blown right now. These are shows I grew up with.
I feel like with this, how this movie is, like round the twist, why didn't he direct that?
he should have. I wish he did. But I guess that could be a wrap for this discussion of Contagion. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on this film?
Yeah, I give it 2 out of 5. Yeah, this movie's just there. It doesn't know what it is. It's a mess. It could have been so much better than it was. Very, very odd. This movie is very, very odd. 2 out of 5.
And Matt, your final thoughts on the film?
Yeah, same minds. I also gave this a 2, out of fives, because that was basically me the entire film.
I'm going to give this about a 1.5 out of 5. Like I said, I appreciate the ideas that it is trying to achieve. But yeah, like I stated before, it just doesn't come together quite well. And the script is just a mess. And I think the performances and the direction pretty much suffer because of it. And sort of looking more into it now, what's interesting about this film, and we'll be talking about this in other films for this show, Marcy, in the future, is like this film was actually released on video. So it went straight to video in Australia. Because you've got to remember, like, this was around the time when the video market was only just beginning. So a lot of filmmakers were like, oh, we don't have to send movies to theaters. We can just drop them on video and make a profit that way. So it wasn't like in the 90s or the 2000s where direct-to-video movies were kind of seen as a low quality, but these were more like, oh, let's take advantage of releasing this on this new format. So, but in this case, yeah, I could definitely see like why they wanted to release a direct-to-video, because it probably would not have done well in the theater.
No.
maybe not.
Yes, indeed. So we'll move on to our next film, which, of course, is the 1987 made-for-TV, surprisingly, slasher film, Coda.
Mike, you're a mess. What are you doing here?
I have to talk to you.
They're looking for you. What have you done?
I haven't done anything. I just came here to see you. I was trying to help her.
Why did you run away?
I panicked. Everybody was shouting at once. I just leaned over her to see if she was still alive, and she started struggling, trying to hit me. Even she thought I was the killer.
Why didn't you tell the police that?
Oh, yeah, sure. Explain to them that I'd been skulking around in the dark waiting for you to come home.
Oh, Mike.
Well, are you going to let me in?
I was out in the corridor and I heard noises. You know, like someone struggling. And then this figure in black charges out and knocks me down. Well, I looked out the window and I saw Anna lying there. Well, you know, there were no witnesses, no proof. Who'd believe me? Do you?
Yes. I don't know why.
Well, I did find something, a key. It was an old-fashioned one. It was in her hand.
Where is it?
I lost it in a drain. Well, the police were chasing me and I slipped. That's why I've been to the hospital. But Anna is the only one who knows what it means. What did you find out?
They think she'll pull through.
Give me your car keys.
How'd you get here?
Taxi.
I'll get you one.
No, look, that'll take too long. Just trust me. Just this once. For old time's sake.
Which was directed by Craig LaHeef. And if I butchered your last name, please forgive me. Written by Craig LaHeef and Terry Jennings. This film stars Penny Cook, Anna Maria Winchester, Liddy Clark, Patrick Frost, Vivian Greaves, and Olivia Hamnett. And the plot summary for this film, which I am once again reading from IMDb, is: a maniac is stalking and killing female students at a university. Okay, that's a pretty simple plot, but you know, we'll work with what we can work with here. So, Coda, again, not to be confused with the Oscar-winning Best Picture film.
Very different movies.
Exactly. So this one I have heard about for quite a while, again, during my research on all things Ozploitation. I made sure to put this one on the list, but at the same time, though, I've heard a lot of very interesting things about it as well. So I was very much looking forward to checking this film out as part of the show. And also what's interesting, too, at the time of this recording, the film had recently been restored and was released as part of Umbrella's Ozploitation Rarities box set, which was the second one. So it's included there and it's now more readily available. But the question is, what did we think of Coda? Marcy, tell us your thoughts on this little movie.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this film. It wears its inspirations on its sleeve. Like, you've got Halloween, you have Brian De Palma, you've got Dario Argento in terms of giallos. And I don't think it's a bad thing, because I think it comes together and it works with those different like elements sort of to do its own thing. But I found it quite entertaining. I was sort of into this mystery and definitely into the visuals of the film. I thought the twist might have been a little bit too obvious, which not necessarily a bad thing, but I think in a film like this, I feel like they could have just been a little more subtle, because I like to be surprised. So when I've guessed it, it's like a bit, all right, then maybe I'm very clever, but I don't think I am. And
I think you're clever.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's in terms of like anything that I think could have improved the film, there's a few little slow spots, but I think overall it does come together really well. I guess, as I said, visually I really, really enjoyed. And I like that we have a mostly female cast, and they all, I think, give really good performances. I really liked Penny Cook's performance, and I like that we had, like, it's a film where it does have this mostly female cast, but the female cast just look like everyday people rather than, oh, we got to have, like, blonde, big-tit, skinny people at the university kind of thing. Especially for something that, it is one of the things you notice very well, like very quickly, is that this does have a predominantly female cast. So, but I really liked this. And I have really enjoyed when these Ozploitation films sort of have that Italian giallo type of vibes and try to do something a bit different with it. I think it's done better in, say, Next of Kin, but I do like that we've seen a few that sort of tackle this in their own different ways.
Mm.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the film.
Actually, to kind of go on what you just said, Marcy, you're absolutely right. Now that I think about it a little bit more, a lot of the Australian slasher films from the 80s definitely had a lot more giallo kind of influence to them, because not just this film, but also Next of Kin, which you mentioned, but I would also add Nightmares, which we discussed.
Yes.
And also even one of the films we discussed on one of the previous episodes, Cassandra, also had a lot of giallo influence as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I will add, this film has the alternate title of Symphony of Evil.
And also Deadly Possession in the United States.
Yeah. So if you don't know it as Coda, you might know it as one of those other names.
Yes.
I like how the United States title is the most boring one. and the one that makes the least sense for the film.
Exactly.
Like, give me Symphony of Evil. That's great.
See, that is a cool title. I do as well. But Matt, tell us your thoughts on Coda.
Yeah, no, I like this one as well. I obviously completely agree with the giallo influence. It's definitely there. I sort of thought of the film, and maybe this is because I've been watching a lot of early Argento lately for January Giallo, but it really felt kind of like early Argento for me. And then, of course, early De Palma, who was heavily influenced by giallo and all those guys. So it had that. And then the John Carpenter aesthetic was a little bit less there. But obviously you see it in like The Mask, which was very William Shatner turned inside out Halloween mask looking. But I mean, a lot of films were kind of copying off that at the time. So no, I like it. It has a certain elegance to it. And I think that kind of maybe ties into a little bit of what Marcy was talking about with the all-female cast and how these aren't women that are being exploited in the film. They're just ordinary people who aren't made to have their tits hanging out and all that kind of stuff, which was very much not the case with early giallo films, which were heavily kind of about putting a voyeuristic eye on women. And so I really appreciated that, and I appreciated the sort of maturity of the movie, I guess, if we can call it that. It's just one of those, like, it's very simple. I also kind of saw the twist coming from a mile away, which is not something you necessarily want with a film. You really want to kind of be surprised by that your first time. But even knowing that, I thought the actress all did a fantastic job, and I just thought it was a nice kind of simple giallo influence film. Like, it didn't overthink anything, like we were just talking about with what's it called, Contagion. It didn't overthink anything, much like Contagion did overthink everything. And I also really like just the last line we get from the villain, where our main character asks just simply why, and they're like, why not? And I just kind of like that idea of the violence existing for no reason, which I always find interesting when you go back and watch older films like this. One, for the fact of, at least here in the States, and I'm sure you two hear it often as well, that we're always kind of, in the horror genre, I feel like we're always kind of saying, where are all the female villain icons? Like, we've got Michael Myers and Freddy Krueger and all these people, and you don't have a lot of like great female horror icons that are like beloved and recognized. And it's always so strange when you go back and watch all these films and you're like, man, they were throwing female villains in left and right in like early giallo and all that kind of stuff. And they're not celebrated, and they should be. I had another thought with that, but now I forgot. Oh, and also just the idea of having no reason behind the killing. I mean, that's something that you started to see coming up more often in Scream, with killers admitting that there really doesn't have to be a motive for people to do this. So I just think it's an interesting film for that, and just going back and kind of seeing where some of these influences came from. And it's also just a very solid, enjoyable film.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. And I think it's a pretty solid little movie overall. It definitely wears its influences on its sleeve. Like, I definitely picked up that sort of giallo vibe there as well. But I also did pick up a little bit of Halloween in there as well, as particularly with the scenes with the actual killer, when you see the killer in the mask. And I think it has a really strong atmosphere, and it has some pretty solid performances as well. And you're right too, it's pretty much a cast where, other than basically one character, it's predominantly female, which I thought was quite interesting. And the fact that it didn't go for sort of like that, the trademarks of what slashes were up to this point in the 80s.
By yeah, having like a male gaze type of.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah, this is definitely, Craig Leif definitely wanted to make, I guess, a grown-up slasher film, or definitely go for more for the giallos.
Well, yeah. Like I was saying, it's a more mature film. It doesn't have that sort of teenage boy gaze to it, right?
Exactly. And yeah, I could definitely see the Brian De Palma influence in there as well. But I also say there's a little bit of Hitchcock there too. And the reveal of the killer is very easy to figure out. So the movie gets a bit of a knock against it for that. But for most part, I did find it quite enjoyable. And the fact that what's interesting too is like it actually was made to be theatrical, but they decided to release it on TV instead, because, and it kind of makes sense, because even though yes, it's a slash film, it's not a very bloody one, and there's very lack of blood in this film, so I think fans of slashes might be disappointed in that regard.
It would have been difficult to market, maybe.
Yeah, but I think it actually is still pretty good. Like I said, it's got good atmosphere and it's well made. Yeah, it's just a really solid little movie all around.
Yeah, that's the best thing I can say. It's actually a really solid and enjoyable film, even if it does wear its influences on its sleeve and you can sort of see what this twist is. I think it at least does something interesting with the twist and why it's there. It could sort of lean into a bit stereotypical, but I feel like it's done in a way that we don't often see, and it's not for the reasons that it would usually be there. So I definitely give it credit for honestly taking its inspirations but doing its own thing.
Yeah, it is really fascinating in that way, where it's like, because again, this was what, a 1987 film, and it feels so antithetical to the rest of the genre at the time, where you did have just these very male-gazy slashers. And even the early giallos, those were all very hyper-fixated on the gaze and the exploitation of these women. And this just feels so different and opposite from that, even though it has these influences, which are obvious. And I didn't mention either, there's a moment that is so clearly ripped out of Halloween where the killer is strangling someone from behind with a cord. Mm-hmm. And it's shot to look almost exactly like the phone scene in Halloween. But other than that, it's so different from what had come before and what was being put out at the time that it's almost kind of surprising to see a film like this from that time period. And I think that's probably what I like most about it, is that it just, again, if you consider the average slasher to be in any way a sort of teenage film, this is, I think you said, Beat, a very adult film maybe in that way. It's just, again, just like a mature giallo. So. Yeah.
Exactly. But I guess this could be a wrap on our discussion of Coda. And Marcel, your final thoughts and rating on this film?
I give it 3.5 out of 5. Yeah, this is one I really quite enjoyed. And again, it's just really cool to see something like this at the late 80s and just being something very different, even though it is obviously inspired by things that have come before, but I feel like it's more inspired by sort of the early to mid 70s rather than the 80s stuff.
I give it a 3 out of 5. I think a negative on it is that, again, the twist isn't very, they make it pretty obvious through the performance of that character, and that was unfortunate. And I think it lacks a little bit of punch that maybe could have improved it a little bit. But other than that, like we've been saying, it's just a solid film, different from what was coming out at the time, and I just really appreciate that about it.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a solid 3 overall. The twist with the killer is very predictable, but I think everything else surrounding it is still pretty solid, nonetheless. Nothing we haven't seen before, but I think it's still handled quite well, and it has, like I said, good solid atmosphere, good performances, and it is well made, so I think if people are interested in checking out, definitely seek it out for sure. And like I say, it's now readily available now. It is completely restored by Umbrella for their Ozploitation Rarities box set series. So if people wanted to check it out, they can. And I'm glad I definitely want to rewatch this film now, mainly because when I watched it in prep for the show, I watched, I think, a banged up VHS copy of it on YouTube. So I'm very curious to see how this movie looks fully restored.
Yeah, I'd also like to pick up Umbrella's copy because I watched the same version you did, and I would like to give it more of a fair shot because I believe in that YouTube version you sent me, there's like a clicking that was going on.
Yes.
For most of the movie, at least that was the case in one of them that you sent. Well, who knows? Maybe with a better restoration and no constant noise.
Well, I kind of hope, and I've always had a suspicion that maybe we're just on the same wavelength, but maybe other people at Umbrella listen to the podcast. I mean, if they do, there are so many films that I would love to see them pick up and restore that we continuously champion. But the fact that they do it all, I feel like it's just amazing that we get that.
Right.
Exactly.
Oh, on to the next movie. And I'm not ready for this.
But... No one is.
Indeed. So we'll move on to our fourth film for this episode. And it is the 1987 horror comedy Outback Vampires.
Just that I'm not used to being found in the altogether by handsome young men. But will you look at you? I've told that girl once, I've told her a thousand times, she's got to keep that bird of hers caged! Here, let me help you wash that off.
What? Oh, no, that's all right, really.
Come on, you bastard! Spit it out!
I'm glad I ran into you, actually. I just wanted to say goodbye.
What?
Yeah, we've troubled you enough as it is, I think.
Oh, no. That will never do. You must stay the night as our guest, I insist.
Well, the others want to get away too, I think.
Well, that loudmouth brother of yours is in no condition to go anywhere. Frau Etzel's put him to bed in one of the guest rooms to sleep it off.
Well, Lucy and I can come and get him in the morning.
Lucy's gone to bed too, I'm afraid.
Can you show me where that is? I really need to chat with her.
I don't think that would be very wise, Nick.
No? Why not?
Well, how can I put this delicately? You see, she's sleeping in George's room.
So?
With George. In fact, he's probably slipping it to her right now. So, that leaves you footloose and fancy free, Nicholas. Just you and me.
Which was directed by a filmmaker who we have talked about a lot on this show, Colin Eggleston. The film was written by David Young and Colin Eggleston. The film stars Richard Morgan, Angela Kennedy, Brett Climo, and John Doyle. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading off IMDb, is what happens when two rodeo men and a female hitchhiker go up against a vampire. And as I sort of stated before, we have covered quite a lot of different films from Colin Eggleston on this show. He's directed quite a variety of different films, I would say, mainly in the horror genre, but they've all been very different. As we know, he started off directing the softcore erotica film Phantasm Comes Again, which I know you're a big fan of, Marcy.
Fabulous.
But he also directed, of course, the Australian horror classic Long Weekend. He also directed Innocent Prey. He also directed the Indiana Jones knockoff Sky Pirates. I know you're a big fan of it as well,
I really
Marcy.
Enjoyed Sky Pirates.
I've never seen Sky Pirates, and I think I need to now.
I would actually be very curious what you think of Sky Pirates. And I think this is more readily available now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it as you're speaking, and just the cover already, I'm sold.
And also he directed, as we sort of mentioned earlier in this episode, Cassandra. So Outback Vampires is actually surprisingly Colin Eggleston's last film that he directed. So this will be the last time we will talk about him for this very show. But the question is, what did we think of his little movie, Outback Vampires? Marcy, tell us your thoughts on this very bizarre little movie.
It almost makes me sad that this was the last film that he would do. This one is also known as The Wicked. The cover art that is on Letterboxd for the film under the title The Wicked is a lot better than the film. I'm just going to put that out there. I'm reading my Letterboxd review because I think it sums up everything. This is Outback Texas Chainsaw Massacre with vampires via the way of the Rocky Horror Picture Show with a random musical number included. That isn't as funny as it wanted to be, and it's not nearly as outrageous as it should have been. This had the potential to be a really fun horror comedy, but it doesn't at all live up to that potential. And I think there's hints of a good, fun film, but in the end, it just feels more like a mishmash of random scenes. I don't know how. It just loses all steam halfway through. It was a film that had the potential to be fun and gruesome, but then it just becomes quite dull. I think there were some decent performances mixed in there, and honestly, the musical number is a bit of an entertaining break from whatever the fuck was happening. Again, the copy that I think we all watched is not a very good VHS copy, and I don't know if it looked more blue than it was meant to. The film should have been sort of my cup of tea, but it's not. But at the same time, like, I feel like people should see whatever the fuck this is. So I would like to see it restored. But again, I believe in doing that to films, even if I don't particularly think they achieved much. I think at the end of the day, Outback Vampires, aka The Wicked, had so much potential and it really didn't get there. As I said, it's not as funny as it wanted to be, and it's not nearly as outrageous as it should have been. And from when it loses steam, it does get quite dull. So I thought, like, this could be something I could love and cherish, but it really didn't get there. And it's very disappointing. I don't even know what it's meant to be. It really feels like they wanted to do something in the vein of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, but just had no idea what to do. And that are my initial thoughts, or my only thoughts, I don't know, on this film.
And Matt, tell us your thoughts on Outback Vampires. And I should say, like, you sent me a message on Blue Sky telling me, what the fuck did I just watch? So tell us your thoughts on this film. Have you figured out what the fuck you just watched?
No, I think I'm more confused than I was when I finished it. So yeah, I'm also with Marcy on this one, where I wanted to like this film so badly. I really, really wanted to like this because I do tend to be a fan of kind of trashier but silly horror films. I am one of the few people you will probably ever meet that likes the film Spookies. And I do because it's ridiculous, right? But it just did not work for me. Like Marcy was saying, it's just not as clever or funny as I think it intends to be. And that's just very unfortunate. I also kind of had my own little reference point for this film where I referred to it as The Hills Have Outback Vampires, because that's kind of how it starts, at least. And then Rocky Horror definitely begins to play a role in this. And I think ultimately maybe the film's downfall is that it, kind of like Contagion, I feel like it's just trying to do too much for its own good, where at a certain point it just feels like it threw the kitchen sink in.
Yeah.
And was almost like it's trying to give you a little bit of everything, and it ultimately sort of suffers from that, because like you ever hear those people that are like, well, I want to know a little bit about everything instead of being an expert in a few things. And while I totally understand that mindset, I always tend to feel like, well, when you know a little bit of everything but aren't an expert in anything, then you don't really know anything. So And that's kind of how this film plays to me, where it's just like you're giving us a little taste of everything, but you don't give us like a good bite of anything.
Yeah, it's weird. I'll say this film is a lot like, in terms of just not knowing what the hell it is and not really getting to its potential in its whatever the fuck it is. One we covered, I think it was a few episodes ago, called Pandemonium. And did we know what the fuck was going on in that movie? I don't think so. A lot of shit was happening in that movie, and I didn't know
Yeah,
what it was.
pandemonium's
It's
pretty
very
nuts.
weird, and it's like, what the fuck is this? And I would say they would make for a why the fuck couldn't you have done more or something else with these two movies? Because they're
Yeah, I
very
mean, this
similar in
is
that way.
like this is I mean, this is definitely one where it's like, I don't know, maybe being high out of your mind helps to enjoy this film
It
further.
did not.
Well, okay, I'll take your word for it then. It just, yeah, it's very, and it's a shame too, because I feel like the actors all commit pretty hard, and you can tell that, at least from an outside perspective, it seems like everyone's having a good time. I did enjoy some of the performances just because they're so strange and quirky. I
I
don't.
think John Doyle was much better in this film.
Yeah. Doyle's good in this. I liked the girl who plays the vampire daughter. I don't know her name, but she seemed to me like she sort of got the assignment, or she's just like so fucking weird. But it's just another one of those that just feels really discombobulated as a film, where you kind of don't really have a context point at any time where you can sort of follow the film. It's really just more of an experience of like a bunch of skits kind of loosely tied together in a way, right? It just, yeah. I do really love giant vampire who, the way they shot it, almost kind of made him feel like 30 feet tall. I thought that was kind of fun to end it on. But yeah, I didn't understand this movie then, and I still don't now, so.
Where to start with my thoughts on Outback Vampires? I'll say this. I'll give Colin Eggleston credit for wanting to do something different, especially because he has, like I sort of stated before, directed quite a number of horror films,
I mean,
and
did
you
he see Pandemonium and was like, I can do that?
can possibly, but
Genius.
you can definitely tell he was trying to, I guess, stretch his wings a little bit by doing other things like Sky Pirates in particular. It feels like an outlier in his work because everything he's done is either horror or thriller, and that was a straight up adventure film. So even though this one is in the horror genre, you could definitely tell he was going for a much more comedic film and making it more of a farce than anything else. But yeah, this is another case like Contagion where it's tried to do so many things, but unfortunately, it just doesn't work. I think visually, the movie does look fine, even though it's
It's
not.
very blue on the VHS
I
rip for
yeah,
some
I was
reason.
wondering about the blue at first too, but then I realized that the blue kind of goes in and out, so I don't think that was part of the lighting.
I don't know. Something tells me I think it was a very deliberate filmmaking choice. You can definitely tell he definitely would do make something very similar to Rocky Horror Picture Show, especially when you have your three main characters come to this small town, and then they get invited up to this big mansion that's fronted by this vampire played by John Doyle. The character, of course, being named Sir Alfred Terminus, and then, of course, his weird family as well. So there's definitely that sort of mixture of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But I think I said this to you the other day, Marcy. I think this film felt more to me like Nothing But Trouble than Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Unfortunately, though, even as a comedy, it's just not funny, and it is a bit of a
No.
slog. A lot of the humor just really falls flat. Like every now and again, there'll be like a pretty funny joke. Although one joke in particular, I will say that did make me laugh because was at the very beginning when our three main characters, Nick, Bronco, and Lucy, They get into a car crash and one of the guys goes smash through the glass window of the car and he's just fine. No problem whatsoever.
Well, this film should have been totally my jam because it operates on cartoon logic like that, right?
Mm. Yeah.
It's really not supposed to make sense, any of it. But I think, like you're saying, just so much of the humor ultimately falls flat. And so having that kind of style doesn't really gel well with the script if you're not also laughing with it and having a good time. So,
Yeah, definitely. And also, it doesn't surprise me, too, that sort of looking more into the film is it was released as a TV movie as well. So I'm starting to see, like, maybe they thought, yes, maybe this film may have been made for as a theatrical release, but you know what? Maybe we'll just release it on TV instead.
I think we're going to find that happened quite a bit, like depending if we can actually find to watch like a lot of stuff that was in the 90s where they essentially just made them for TV or the channels just picked up these like low budget films to fill their quota of Australian content. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if this was played like very late at night on Australian television. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
So late at night that nobody ever saw it.
Around 3 a.m. in the morning.
Yep. I mean, look, I was awake at those times because like after midnight, you used to get like Freddy's Nightmares, stuff like that. So I was definitely up late, but no, don't remember seeing this.
And I agree with both of you. I think John Doyle definitely works better here because he's flexing his comedic muscles.
His comfort zone.
Yeah, exactly. It's more of his comfort zone more than a dramatic performance like he was in Contagion. He was definitely fun when he was on screen. I think the cast do try with what they're given, but yeah, I just don't think the script really worked for any of them, which is a shame because the fact that this is Colin Eggleston's last film that he made before he passed away in 2002 is kind of sad because, like, as we discussed on the show, Marcy, he had made more hits than misses. I mean, Lost Weekend is like an Australian horror classic. So it's kind of interesting, like, this film was kind of the last thing he did. I don't know whether it's a case maybe he wanted to make more films, but he just wasn't able to get them made. Or maybe he kind of just decided to just retire. It's kind of a shame because he's definitely one of the most common filmmakers we have talked about on this show. So it's kind of sad that this was the very last thing he made.
Indeed.
No, it is. And it's that unfortunate case of like a lot of filmmakers, as much as we all wish this wasn't the case, and as much as I'm sure they do, everyone kind of just starts to fall off eventually. Like you do this long enough and eventually the films aren't quite at the level of what you were known for. The thing I will give this though is that I think if you watch Long Weekend and then this film, at first maybe you're kind of like, the same director made these movies? But I appreciate that experimentation. I appreciate the way, I think you put it, Beat, of kind of like flexing your wings or stretching your wings, because I'm sure a lot of filmmakers, you don't want to be stereotyped into one kind of film. Like, you don't want to be forced to do just that one kind of thing. You want to try lots of stuff. And so I appreciate that in this case, he's really going way out there and trying a lot of different things. I mean, I didn't even mention the fact that a lot of this randomly references the old ones and Lovecraft mythos and just all this random shit to throw in with vampires. So I respect it. It just, yeah, it's unfortunate that this was the last thing that he did.
Indeed, indeed. But I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of Outback Vampires. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on the film?
Yeah, I give this 2. I really wish this were a lot more outrageous than it turned out to be, out of 5. I don't know. I just wanted more out of a film that just felt like it was right up my alley. And it's just a shame that it's not as funny as it should be. It's not as outrageous as it really needed to be. And that it just really sort of just loses steam and doesn't really recover from it. And it sort of just there. But what a weird fucking experience that was.
And Matt, your final thoughts and rating on the film?
Yeah, Marcy and I are like in sync on this episode. I'm gonna give it 2 what the fuck was that out of 5, because I felt similarly. Like, this was, of all of these films, this was probably the most disappointing experience for me, just because it really, really felt like something that I should have connected with and enjoyed, and I just could not find that within the film. I respect it for what I think it was trying to do. I appreciate the silliness of it. It just really mostly fell flat for me.
I'm going to give this film 1.5 out of 5. Like Contagion, there are definitely elements that I think are very interesting. And you could definitely tell that everyone involved with this film was just having an absolute blast while making it. But unfortunately, I don't feel like that sort of sense of fun really translated into the actual film itself. It just becomes a bit of an unfunny slog. I mean, I'm willing to give this film a chance again if it does get restored in the future and just find out if that blue tint was actually part of the film or not. And who knows, stranger things have happened. Sometimes a movie, if it gets a bit of an upgrade, you can appreciate it a lot more. Even with this banged up VHS copy, or if it was taped off the TV, I'm not sure. Regardless, though, it was definitely a misfire from Colin Eggleston. It's not, I think, his worst film. That's still Phantasm Comes Again, but this one's a very close second.
Well, I don't know, Marcy, would you agree with this as Phantasm Comes Again?
I think I'd rather watch Outback Vampires than Phantasm Comes Again.
Yeah, okay.
And me being a person who enjoys the pornography.
Yes. But we'll move on to our fifth and final film for this episode. And it's probably the most well-known of the bunch we're talking about today. And I know it's the one that I know, Matt, you're very much looking forward to discussing for this show. And that, of course, is the 1987 sequel, Howling Free, The Marsupials.
A terrifying legend never dies. It lives on. You were frightened in the howling. And you'll be horrified as never before as the howling terror continues in Howling 3, the most terrifying howling of all.
I wonder how many more of them there are out there.
Jesus.
But how many of them have we killed over the years? They're nearly extinct.
I think they're dangerous. Evolutionary freaks.
We possess evidence that werewolves exist.
Where? For God's sake.
Australia.
Jeez. Ah! Oh, g'day. Want to put a shrimp on the barbie?
Ah!
The howling terror continues with a whole new breed of werewolves in Howling 3, rated PG-13.
Which was written and directed by Philippe Mora, and this film stars Barry Otto, Imogen Ansley, Lee Biolas, Dagmar Blavova, Ralph Cottrell, and Barry Humphreys. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading again off IMDb, is: a female werewolf runs away from her family and falls in love with a man who works in the movie business. While a sociologist who studies these creatures is looking for proof of their existence. Now, as you would expect, this is the third entry in the Howling series, and the second up to this point to be directed by Philippe Mora, who we have talked about on this show because he also directed Mad Dog Morgan and The Return of Captain Invincible.
Fucking thing is an incredible movie and everyone should watch it.
But he also directed The Howling 2. That was a film that was critically reviled, even though it has a bit more of a cult status now, but at the time it was hated by critics and seen by many as a step down after the first film. And I know Philippe Mora didn't have the best of times while making that film due to studio interference. So when they came to him to make the third film in the franchise, he pretty much said to him, you know what? I will do it, but I want to be given full creative control of this entry. And also, I want it to be set in Australia as well. And the end result ended up being The Howling 3, The Marsupials. But the question is, though, what do we think of this film? Marcy, tell us your thoughts on Howling 3, The Marsupials.
Yes, well, I just want to say again, everyone should go see The Return of Captain Invincible. If you want a film where Christopher Lee has musical numbers as the villain, it's incredible.
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
It is. I truly, honestly, I praise so much love on that movie when we talked about it on a previous episode. But I'll get to this one. Well, you know what? I'll probably never actually understand how this film is as good as it is. And I don't think that's a bad thing, because this is a very weird piece of Australian cinema. At the same time, it makes perfect sense, because why would you not take the werewolf mythos and add sort of an Australiana to it by having there be sort of were-marsupials, because we obviously have a lot of marsupials in Australia. Why would these marsupials, why would they not have a pouch to keep the baby? And why would a film called The Howling 3, The Marsupials, not show that? Because of course it does, and it's amazing. This is literally me just blabbing because I just think this movie is great. For some reason, I thought the birthing in the pouch scene was at the end, and the weird shit that happens at the end was in the middle. So when I rewatched it, I'm like, oh shit, I've remembered this so wrong.
And oh, yeah, that's like, oh, dude, this makes
so much more sense now that I'm watching it, that these things happen in that order. It's a fucking genuine movie. But it's funny because you've got like a love story, you've got the horror aspect, you've got a bit of drama, you've got a bit of action going on, but it's campy as all fuck. And it just works. I don't know why. It works. I have a lot of love for this film. I love that we have these practical effects. I love that we have a baby marsupial web creature in a pouch. It's just great. And it, honestly, like, there are love stories in this film and it's very touching. But then we have the scenes of like the marsupial were nuns. It's like, what the fuck? And then, of course, the ending, it just goes insane. So it kind of adds like a bit of body horror as well as being very much Australian. But it's got this weird, interesting thing about like this sort of as if they're like a cryptoid that just happens to be real, that people are investigating, where people are kind of taking it seriously. But then it's just got this love for cinema as well. I almost feel like changing my rating to be higher on this film, because as I'm talking about it, I'm like, I just fucking adore this movie. And rewatching it was just a joy. I got to hand it to Philippe Mora, because I like and enjoy The Howling 2. We did a really insane commentary on it on After Dark last year. And you could see he had some weird and wacky ideas, and they really come to, the whole thing just comes out in The Howling 3. But again, like something like Mad Dog Morgan is such a very different film. The tone is very different, but he was given Dennis Hopper doing whatever the fuck he wanted and just made something really interesting. But he's got a very sort of interesting career, because One of his films scared the shit out of me, and to this day I have not rewatched it, was Communion with Christopher Walken. I know I'm going to rewatch it and be like, why was I scared of this? But aliens have always freaked me out. So I think he's got a very bizarre, all over the place filmography, but I think it's very interesting. And Yeah, the more I just talk and think about The Howling 3, I think the more I really love this movie. I'm going to let Matt talk about it because I know he's dying to, and I'm just rambling right now.
No, it's totally fine. So as a fellow lover of this film, I love just hearing someone else rant about all of the qualities that make them adore it. So Marcy basically said like everything that I sort of feel about this film. I want to quickly say I'm an idiot, and going back to the question that you asked me at the start of this, Howling 3 was the first Australian horror film that I ever saw, not Wolf Creek. But aside from that, yeah, so I love the Howling franchise altogether more than most people probably should. And I want to say that I appreciate Philip Moore for taking the werewolf lore twice. Well, technically three times if you count The Beast Within, which isn't necessarily a werewolf film, but it deals with a lot of similar aspects. But him taking it twice and saying, you know what? How can I do the most fucked up, bizarre werewolf film ever made? And he did it two times with Howling 2 and Howling 3, because each of those qualifies as the two most bizarre werewolf films ever made. So Howling 3, I'm with Marcy. I actually really enjoy this film. I think it knows exactly what it is. The characters are well written. It does have everything you want. The romance, the suspense, the weirdness, the surprises. It's a fun film and it's campy. And I mean, we're talking about a movie here that has werewolf nuns, marsupial werewolves with pouches, and a baby marsupial werewolf that looks like a fucking alien. It's kind of adorable. And werewolf gods that come into the bodies of a werewolf and become enormous and are blown up by fucking rocket launchers. It's just, there's just so much to this film that it's really hard to just not have a good time with it. And as a werewolf fanatic, I just really adore it because it is so different from anything else that exists in the genre that for me, I'm just endlessly fascinated by it. Like Marcy said, I don't know how this is a good film. I don't know how it's actually turned out to be something that I really enjoy, but it is. And yeah, I'll leave it there because I know we'll keep talking about it. I don't want to keep rambling.
We could keep rambling because it is The Howling 3. I will say, before I let Bede speak, I always thought I really love the idea of being a werewolf, but I honestly would be like a were-marsupial now. I kind of want a pouch. I kind of want that little baby.
The pouch is pretty dope. I just carry it around in your little pouch and yeah.
Be like, excuse me, I don't care if you're getting too old for your mummy. You're coming back in here.
Yeah.
Yes. To be one of those overbearing were-marsupial mothers.
I'd like to have the pouch just so that when someone pissed me off, the little marsupial baby could just like pop out and give them the finger.
Yes.
Like that would be my version of giving the finger is the baby would just do it.
Yes. I wanted to just pop out and just yell profanities at people.
Yes, exactly. So something I'll add is that going back to how this is actually a decent film, at least in our minds, I think that it also takes a piece of the werewolf lore that I appreciate, and that for as far back as we can go in films about werewolves, it's always kind of been about the sort of curse of being a werewolf. And in this case, it's not necessarily a curse. Like these people are their own community and they're proud of that community. What it does here that I think is interesting is it really gives a sympathetic lens to the werewolf in just the fact that they are this community that's hunted by people, kidnapped and experimented on and tortured. And
they're essentially the X-Men.
Yes.
The mutants in the X-Men.
Yes, in a way they are the X-Men. And I just think that's really cool. It's probably the part of me that's such a fan of werewolves that I like seeing them put in this light, which is especially interesting when you consider that the first two films are quite the opposite of that, where the werewolves are very much villainous. So I like it here, kind of giving a little different outlook on it and really making us care about these characters and sort of putting ourselves in their shoes of what it would be like to be this monster as viewed by the rest of society. So anyway, Bede, what are your thoughts? We haven't heard from you yet.
Where to start with my thoughts on Howling Free the Marsupials? Well, there's a lot to talk about with this film. I should state the first time I watched this film, as we all know, I'm not the biggest Howling 2 fan. We could put that out there on
you're
the record.
Oh, you're not? Dude, if I remember right, during the Howling 2 conversation, I believe you called Howling 2 a masterpiece.
A masterpiece of shit. But anyways,
how dare you?
So, when I watched Howling 3 for the first time, I was definitely more curious, especially since having heard everything about it, especially given that Philippa Amore had a troubled time on the second film. He was given more free reign
Again, I'm not letting you talk, but just thinking, what year was The Howling 3 and when was The Return of Captain Invincible? Was that made after The Howling 2?
Yes, Captain Invincible was made before Howling 2.
That makes sense why Christopher Lee was in it.
Yes.
Because he was in The Return of Captain Invincible. And yeah, because I thought, surely it couldn't have been first, because if Christopher Lee made Howling 2, I don't think he would have worked Philip Morrow again.
I don't think he would have come back for that, yeah.
Yeah, so that actually makes total sense. He agreed to be Howling 2 after being in a superhero spoof where he sings as the villain, so that's kind of amazing.
Yeah, yes. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that he thought The Howling 2 was going to be a much different experience than it turned out to be.
And my favorite thing to come out of that movie is that when he worked on Gremlins 2, he personally apologized to Joe Dante for starring in that movie.
But he should never apologize for his iconic look of wearing those fucking sunglasses.
Yes.
Howling 2. God, I love him specifically just for that moment.
Anyway, Bede, sorry.
Anyway, yes,
that's all right. Bede. Well, the first time I watched part three, I definitely enjoyed it a lot more than part two, but I was still very mixed on it. But now having rewatched it again as part of this show, I definitely would say it's definitely a lot better than I remembered. It is a very wacky, over-the-top film. But there's a bit of sincerity at the heart of it.
Genuine film. It really
is. And I think it's because, and you touched on this, Matt, is basically kind of you got the werewolf family who basically just want to live their lives, live in their own little community. And of course, they're being hunted by society. So you can definitely feel a lot of sympathy for the werewolves
There's a lot of heart in it. It's a very heartfelt film, which you would not expect based on how bizarre it really is.
Indeed. And I think that's probably the key to enjoying this film, is if you're going to make a film as weird and wacky and over the top as this film, you've got to have some sincerity to it and also some heart to it at the center of it. And I think Philippa Amore actually does that quite well with this film. Like, I felt more of him in this film than I did with part two, because knowing the behind-the-scenes history of part two, you could definitely sort of sense that distance from his filmmaking in that one. Like, he wasn't fully engaged as he could have been with that one. But with this film, he's definitely just firing all cylinders. And this is basically his Gremlins 2 in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think you could say that.
Because he's just been given all this money to make whatever he wanted, and he just makes something as bizarre and this. And I love that he really goes forth with the were marsupial angle, and it really just makes the film feel so Australian. But I also like the fact that the film is very much a satire on filmmaking and also Hollywood as well, because you have one of the main characters of Jabora, played by Imogen Ansley, who leaves her where marsupial tribe to go to the city, and she ends up being cast in a werewolf movie.
She gets cast, like, straight away.
Exactly.
Isn't it, like, I'm trying to remember, does she walk onto the set of the film? Or no, they find her somewhere, right?
I think so, yeah, because she meets the character of, I believe it's Donnie, who works on the film, and he invites her on
to that's right.
the film, and then they strike up a relationship, and that's where they develop a romance as well. And also, there's a lot of actors who we have seen before in other films that we've covered on this show. Michael Pate, who also played the president in The Return of Captain Invincible, is also plays a president in this film, but also Frank Tiring is the director of the movie, and also Max Fairchild, who plays Philo, who's the one he wants to get with Jabora from the Werewolf Tribe. He has been in a lot of stuff we've talked about for this show, like the Mad Max films, and also Burnham Burnham, who we talked about on Dark Age, is also in this film as well. And then this is only like one of three films that he made, and he's a lot of fun. But I also like the fact that Barry Otto, one of Australia's greatest actors, he's in this as well. He is kind of playing this movie off like Michael Caine in The Muppet Christmas Carol, yes. where he is playing it absolutely straight and sincere, and just treating this like it is a very dramatic work. Mm-hmm. Like, you can definitely tell there's no...
Are you saying it's not, dude?
I mean, it could be, but I mean, in terms of, like, you could definitely see, like, he is taking this material seriously and is not winking at the camera. Like, it's not to say there isn't a bit of that in this film, because clearly everyone who worked on this movie knew exactly what type of film they were in. But you could, Barry Otto in particular, I feel like when it comes to the film's heart and sincerity, it's also he that kind of provides it as well, because he is just playing it so straight in this absolute cake of madness we're watching.
What I really like with the film is we get that romance with Jaboa and Donnie, but it's a very kind of sincere one. Like, you see a scene of them, and I don't know if he knows that she's a were-marsupial, but he very clearly sees and feels her very hairiness where the pouch is, and he's not fazed by it. And I'm like, you know what? We need more of that in film, because he knows what she is, and he's not judging her on that she's different.
Well, I was going to say, first, he sees the six nipples, and he's like, score.
Yeah.
But
he's like, he can breastfeed also.
But in all seriousness, no, like that's something I adore about the movie as well, right? Is that it is like, that's kind of what's at the heart of it, is you have Donnie kind of like, it's Donnie, right? Yeah, you kind of have him, like Marcy said, like seeing how different she is, and that doesn't faze him. Like, I think most people, the six nipples in the pouch thing might be pushing the line for them. And I appreciate that Donnie's able to just see that and be, no, like, what matters is my feelings for her, not our differences. And I just think it's kind of a beautiful thing, because you also see that happen with Professor Harry Beckmeyer, I believe, who falls in love with one of the werewolf women or the marsupials. And I don't know, like, there's, like, you can certainly write the film off as just being goofy and all that kind of stuff, but I do think there's something really beautiful at the heart of it, especially with the professor too, of just someone who's kind of studied these tribes from afar, and rather than be off-put or horrified by it or anything like that, he himself sees the humanity and kind of the beauty of it. And I don't know, I like how we're probably talking about this and Bede's just like
maybe we're making this movie deeper than it is. I don't know,
but
I feel like the stuff like that is what was missing from a couple of the films that we have just talked about. This movie can be batshit insane, but it's genuine. It has a heart. It's got two love stories, I guess, because Professor Barry Otto also falls in love in this film. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole acceptance and them just wanting to live. And it's like, yeah, I can see a lot of similarities with things that are happening today, where people who are slightly different are struggling to just get accepted and live. And it's like, yeah, nah, like, I mean, I hope werewolves or were-marsupials are real, but I can imagine the outrage of today. And oh my gosh, we can't have this happen. It's like, oh my god,
it'd be like the X-Men, right? Like,
yes, us beautiful is our differences. I don't know, I'm making this way more profound than it is, but with so much division in this day and age, I just feel like we could have so much more love and understanding for each other.
Right.
Indeed.
Yeah, it's that frustrating thing of like, you watch a film like this, and the film puts both on display, right? You see these relationships built between this community and these outsiders, and depending on which way you look at it, you see this beautiful relationship that forms between them where differences are put aside, or even better, differences are appreciated. And then you see the people that are hunting them and trying to kill them simply because they're different. It's films like that that just really make you sit back for a moment and think how much more enriching society would be if we were all like the professor and Danny and just able to see people for who they are instead of what they are or whatever. And yeah, it's unfortunate that we so often tend to be the soldiers hunting them instead, because we're just so often not allowed to be different. So yes, we are making this more profound maybe than it deserves.
Beach, do you have anything else to add?
Well, when I started watching this movie, I did not expect Dame Edna to show up at the end of this movie, but I should have, given that Barry Humphries did work with Philippa Mora on a few films. So it was just hilarious that Dame Edna just popped up at the end in the sort of the mock Oscar award ceremony, which kind of plays up the ending of the original film as well.
Yeah, it does. And I think it's clever that it does it with that sort of Hollywood thing and playing up the original, but in such a different way and with such a different meaning for it. It's just great, honestly. And I cut you off again. I'm sorry.
And also, I just had to laugh because Jabora and Donnie, they go to the movies and they watch a werewolf movie.
I love that werewolf. Now I'm cutting you off, but I love that werewolf with the, like, what is it? Like, just the giant snout? That...
Yes. I was just sitting there laughing to myself, and
it's great
because it just reminded me of The Simpsons. Whenever the characters go to the movies, they see that alien horror movie series that they're watching, Space Mutants. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of was like looking it up, and I think this film was an inspiration for Space Mutants because there was a segment from one of the episodes called Space Mutants 5, The Land Down Under, and one of the aliens had a baby alien in its pouch.
Oh. it has to be then. Yep.
So obviously this movie is definitely at least well known enough to at least have The Simpsons kind of spoof it in their own way.
And I will say, this movie on a visual level is really awesome.
Yeah.
It's got some great shots. Like that, the movie within a movie looks great.
Yeah, the movie within a movie looks so good in just a fun way that like I kind of want to see that movie. But yeah, no, it is really well shot in some cases where there's a lot of personality to this film that I think is missing from at least one or two of the Howling films, especially Part 7 that Clive Turner directed.
And also, this film was edited by Lee Smith, who would go on to win an Oscar for editing Dunkirk and also edited The Dark Knight and Batman Begins.
Gotta start somewhere.
Exactly. And funnily enough, he edited Dark Phoenix, so there's your X-Men connection right there.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, and X-Men First Class. So it's all coming together.
Amazing.
This was like one of those posts you could make on socials and be like, Howling 3 and X-Men First Class. These had the same editor.
Exactly. But I guess that could be a wrap for this discussion of Howling 3, the Marsupials. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this film.
This film is just great. It really is. My current rating is 3.5 out of 5, but I'm sure it'll go to 4 when I watch it again. And how profound I'm apparently making this movie. But honestly, it boggles the mind how this is so good, but it honestly deserves to be so good. Everyone should go see The Howling 3, The Marsupials.
And Matt, your final thoughts and a rating for the film.
Yeah, so I mean, Marcy and I are talking about it like it's a 5-star film, and it's not bad.
Are you saying it's not, Matt?
And I think that might be going too far. But again, I do just, I feel like if you're a fan of the werewolf genre, I just think that Howling 2 and especially this are just such unique entries within the genre that are so full of just things that you will not see in any other werewolf film, that I think that for that very thing alone, it makes it worthwhile. But like we've been saying, it's a film with heart. It's got a lot of great stuff to it. I think it adds a lot to the werewolf lore that is pretty interesting, that I wish the franchise explored a bit more. But all that being said, not 5 stars. I also have this at a 3.5, but I do really, really enjoy this movie, and I think everyone should watch it as well.
I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5 as well. I think,
What?
yes, surprisingly,
So
but
we all had the same rating for the first movie we discussed and the last movie we discussed.
indeed.
Nice. Synchronicity.
Exactly. But yeah, I think it's a movie that knows exactly what it is, and it fully embraces its own insanity. It also does have heart to it, which I think really sort of elevates it. I mean, I haven't seen any of the Howling sequels past this one yet, but I know their quality is just absolutely insane with every installment. So I look forward to finally watch the
Yeah,
sequels.
I actually don't think I've really seen them, or if I have, I don't remember.
Well, so I will say right off the bat, 5 is actually pretty damn good, because it's basically like the Beast Must Die, but in the 80s or early 90s version. It's pretty cool. It's a murder mystery with the werewolf, and it's set in a gothic castle during a winter storm. I really like 5. 5 is my second favorite, actually, in the franchise. The others are fine to terrible. The Howling 7 I consider to be the worst werewolf film ever made.
And I've heard a lot about this,
And I have
so I don't
seen
know.
quite a few bad werewolf movies. You'll have to see it for yourself to know why.
I'm kind of intrigued now.
It's an interesting franchise in that no one film out of all 8 of them, if you include Howling Reborn, which is kind of a remake, and 4 is kind of a remake as well, but all 8 of them are just so different from each other that it's kind of a really fascinating werewolf franchise.
Well, I definitely look forward to checking those ones out. So, yeah, I would say it's a really solid movie and it's a lot of fun, and definitely one that I think if anyone wants to check out other entries from the series, just check out this one. I
Yeah.
guess that could be a wrap for this episode 21 of the Ozboycast. And thank you, Marcy, once again, for always being a very awesome co-host.
You're awesomely welcome.
And thank you, Matt, for coming on the show and talking about these various qualities of Australia of Ozploitation films. And I apologize for some of them that you've been subjected to.
Always a pleasure, and thank you both for being awesome podcast
You're welcome.
But before we wrap up the show today, Marcy, where can people find you and also your good work, and as well as all things the Super Network out there on the internet this week?
Yeah, if you want more on this podcast or any other podcast that we do together, check out supermarcy.com. Or you can look up the Ozploitcast on your podcast streaming players of choice. Or you can find all the handy links to the Super Network socials and podcasts at the link tree, which is linktr.ee/thesupernetwork. And I can be found on various socials under Super Marcy, and I am super_Marcy on Letterboxd.
And Matt, where can people find you and your good work out on the internet this week? And also, Matt, do you have things out there at the moment you would like to promote as well?
Geez, I don't know. It's like you're hinting at something, dude. Yes, I do. First, you can find me on Blue Sky at Weremat. You can go to my website, killerhorrortrick.com, where I occasionally post horror reviews. I have columns that I do on Daily Grindhouse and Manor Vellum. I also occasionally write for Dread Central. And then, as Bede was mentioning, speaking of Umbrella, it was just announced that they're releasing a Thai horror collection, which I contributed an essay as well as did all the interviews for. And they also just announced a release of Shudder, not the terrible American remake, but the original Thai horror film. which I also did the interviews for that as well. So
very
go
cool.
Pick those up. The releases are amazing and hope you enjoy them if you do.
Well, I think you can pre-order them for the May release at the Umbrella website.
And if people were to find me personally out there on the internet, you can follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bede Jermaine. You can find all my work over at supermarcy.com and as well as all the other awesome podcasts that Marcy and I co-host together on the Super Network. And if you want to follow my other shows, you can follow my solo shows, Bede vs. the Living Dead, and as well as its other shows within its little universe, like Bede and Steve vs. Camp Crystal Lake, Bede and Steve vs. Leatherface, and Bede and Sam vs. the Video Nasties on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Bede vs. the Living Dead podcast feed or on their own separate individual podcast feeds as well. But yes, that is a wrap for this long-awaited new episode of the Ozploit Cast. We hope you all enjoyed listening to this one. And we will be back next month for episode 22, in which we will be looking at the films Initiation, Les Patterson Saves the World, Breaking Loose, Summer City 2, Day of the Panther, and Strike of the Panther. Stay tuned for that episode next month, everyone, and we'll see you all next time. See you, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Go watch Howling 3.
Don't you worry, buddy, 'cause here he comes through the ghettos and